Shema. We're now going to diverge from the kinot which deal directly with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and look at some of the other and historical themes that are discussed on Tisha B'Av. We're going to move now to the kinah of Arzei HaLevanon. The Arzei HaLevanon kinah is a dirge, a eulogy for the Asara Harugei Malchut, the 10 rabbis who were martyred by the Romans in the generations after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, some 50, 60, 70 years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. We've discussed, I think, previously the martyrdom of Rabbi Akiva, the martyrdom of Rabbi Hananya ben Taradion, and today I want us to look at the death and martyrdom of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, of one of the Tanaim, a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva. We're starting on page 8 in the Kuntras. But Rav Soloveitchik makes the observation that the martyrdom and the murder of the Asara Harugei Malchut, that came a number of years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. He says that when the Romans destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, they didn't actually outlaw Torah and Mitzvot. They thought that the heart of the Jewish people was the Beit HaMikdash, and if there was no Beit HaMikdash, then that would kill Am Yisrael. That without a Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish people wouldn't be able to survive. And then they saw that it was a terrible tragedy for Am Yisrael that there was no Beit HaMikdash, but in actual fact, if not thriving, at least the Jewish people were able to survive moderately well, even after the Beit HaMikdash, because they still had Torah, they were still able to learn Torah, they were still able to observe the mitzvot. And therefore it was a generation or two later that they realized that that's what we have to eradicate. It wasn't enough destroying the Beit HaMikdash, that might have been the heart, but the soul of the Jewish people is the Torah. And that's why they wanted to destroy the teachers of Torah. That's the Asara Harugei Malchut. We talk here about the 10 martyred teachers of Torah, but we don't actually find 10 listed. I think we've only got 8 in this Kinah. The other time we talk about the Asara Harugei Malchut is on Yom Kippur, when at the end of the Seder HaAvodah, we have the Eile Ezkara Piyut. Again, we talk about the 10 martyred rabbis. We don't have quite the same list there as we have here. And again, it's not 10. There are other sources as well, and in total I think there are 13 or 14 names mentioned. The way the Piyutim described it is they were all martyred at one time, but historically that's not true, but it doesn't need to be true. The point is that the lifeblood of the Jewish people was under threat with the martyrdom of these rabbis. Now, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, who's described in the Talmud as being a tzaddik, being a righteous person. We don't know a lot about him. We'll see that he was a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva and an important aspect of his life when we learn the sugya from Masechet Sanhedrin about how he died. The Piyutim of Arzei HaLevanon and Eile Ezkara actually don't tell us much about him or his life and his death. If we look at what we're going to read from Arzei HaLevanon, I've just taken out those couple of lines for you, that so we say Ben Bava Rabbi Yehuda Acharav Heviu, they brought Rabbi Yehuda Ben Bava B'Shivron Lev Azhara, that he was broken hearted Neherag Ben Shivim Shana Bidei Arura, he was 70 years old when he was murdered by the cursed enemy Yoshev B'Tar Nitaya, that day he was fasting Naki the Chassid Bimlachtola Mahara. He was Naki, he was guiltless of any wrongdoing. He was a Chassid Bimlachtola Mahara. He always wanted to finish off what he was doing, finish off any mitzvot that he was involved in. So it doesn't really tell us, other than the fact that he was fasting, how he died. That's Eile Ezkara on Yom Kippur. Tells us even less. That we've got various lines, and then the last line that we've got in front of us, Ki iskimul harog asara tzadikim, they agreed they were going to kill 10 righteous people. Im Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, together with Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. Now, it's particularly interesting that there's no mention in these piyutim of how Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was killed. Why is it particularly interesting? Because the Gemara actually tells us. So, you know, we've got a source which tells us about it. So I don't know why the Paitanim ignored the Gemara. Let's look at the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin. Pamachat gazra malchut harasha'a gezeira al Yisrael. So once upon a time, the Romans, the wicked Romans, made a gezeira against the Jewish people. Shekol hasomech yehareig. That anybody who grants smicha to anybody else will be killed. Now, why, you know, just for giving smicha? Why giving smicha? Why not just teaching Torah? What's the significance of giving smicha? Of course, the significance of giving smicha is the Masorah, is the chain of tradition going from one generation to the next, and the authority to teach Torah. That's really what smicha is all about. It's a link with the past and bringing it on to the future. And that's what the Romans wanted to stop. They wanted to sever that link between the scholars of tomorrow with the scholars of the past. Once there's no smicha, so people can come up with a few chidushim. They can give a shir here or there, but it lacks the authority of being the authentic tradition. So that's what the Romans wanted to try and eradicate. So they said anybody who gives smicha will be put to death. The chol hanismach yehareig, and anybody who receives smicha will be put to death. The esheshomchin ba techarev, and any city where smicha is given will also be destroyed. That's very significant as well. Why do you destroy the cities where they're giving smicha? Because there might be a few individuals who are willing to risk their lives to give smicha, to receive smicha. Once you put a threat of collective punishment, then it's going to make everybody frightened. Havdil elef alfei havdalot. We see this in Israel now. That, you know, why are the houses of families of terrorists destroyed? Because it might be that the terrorist doesn't care if he loses his life murdering some Jews. But when the whole family is going to have their house destroyed and be left in poverty, then there's going to be social pressure to stop this happening. So that's what the Romans understood as well. And they understood if they put social pressure on people that there shouldn't be smicha, then even a few brave people aren't likely to go and do it. And not just the immediate vicinity, but anywhere within the tchum, anywhere within 2,000 amot, anywhere where you could walk to on Shabbat, will also be destroyed. So they wanted to create a situation whereby that's not just, you know, we're not saying you don't do smicha, but don't let any of the people that you know give smicha or receive smicha. That's Masar Yehuda ben Bava. So what did Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava do? Halach v'yashav lo ben shnei harim gedolim. He went outside of town, and he went and positioned himself between two great mountains, uvein shtei ayarot gedolot, between two big cities, uvein shnei tchumei Shabbat, between two tchumin, bein Usha l'Shafram, between the cities of Usha and Shafram. So he went outside the town. He didn't want to harm anybody else. So he went to a place where, you know, yes, the Romans can come and they can blow up the whole area, but it's a desolate area, so it doesn't matter. V'samach sham chamisha zakenim. And he gave smicha there to five zakenim. Who were the five zakenim? Now, we might not know Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava so well. If I'd, you know, said at the beginning, who recognizes the name Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava? Maybe not everybody would have put up their hands. But now we've got, you know, the most famous names. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. That's so five of the most well-known Tanaim, they received smicha from Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, which tells us something about who Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was. Rav Avia Mosif af Rabbi Nechemia. Rav Avia says there were six, it was Rabbi Nechemia as well. What's the significance of whether it was five or six? I suspect these numbers aren't random. What's the significance of giving smicha to five Talmidei Chachamim? Chamishachum Shei Torah. So this is representing the fact that when Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava gave smicha now to five sages, he was protecting and saving the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, which were in danger of being obliterated. Why does Rav Avya add in a sixth? Shisha Sidrei Mishnah, that it wasn't just the written Torah that he was protecting, but it was also the oral Torah that he was protecting. That's just a hunch that I have, that these numbers aren't random and that they're significant. They're symbolic of what he was, not just who he was trying to protect, but what he was trying to protect. Kevan Sheki Roy Vehem Bahen. Once the enemy saw what had happened, Amalahen, he said to them, Banai Rutsu. That's my students, my sons, my Talmidim, run away. You've got to get away from here. You're going to be killed. Amrulor, they said to him, Rebbe Mate Alecha, our teacher, what's going to happen to you? You're an old man, you can't run as fast as us. We don't want to leave you. Amar Lahen, he said to them, don't worry about me. Hareini mutal lifnehem ke'even shein lahofcheim. I'm like a stone which can't be overturned. What do you mean I can't be overturned? They can't harm me anymore. I've done what I needed to do. I've given you smicha, it doesn't matter what happens to me, don't worry. Amru, they says, Lo zazu misham, the Romans didn't depart from there, ad shenatsu bo shlosh meot lun viot shel barzel, until they pierced him with 300 iron spearheads, vasahuk chavara, and they turned him into like a sieve. It's like, taking a fork and plunging it into his skin all around so that, holes everywhere. Blood coming out everywhere. So I presume there's a significance to the number 300 here. I don't know what that significance is. But anyhow, it's interesting. The Gemara tells us how and why Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was martyred. He was martyred for teaching Torah and for preserving the Masorah and the link between the past and the present and the future, and protecting the five sages or the six sages, the Chamisha Chumshei Torah or the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. He was killed by the Romans shooting arrows or plunging spearheads into him till he became like a sieve. And I don't know why the Piyutim, Arzal Vanon and Eile Eskara, don't tell us anything about it. Okay, let's turn over the page. And we'll just see that Rav Benny Lau, in his book The Sages, talks a little bit about this notion of the tradition. That he says the story is primarily concerned not with the death of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, but with the preservation of the line of halachic transmission. The Talmud's term for ordination is smicha, which refers to the act of appointing a sage to a particular position and authorizing him to adjudicate cases involving penalties. Teachers need a way of entrusting their responsibility and knowledge to qualified students to enable the seamless continuity of the halakhic system. Without some form of ordination, there is no means of authorizing a new generation to teach and judge the public. Any rupture in the line of transmission endangers the entire Jewish future. Thus, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava's willingness to sacrifice his own life for the sake of ensuring that a new generation of rabbis would be ordained was exceedingly consequential. He linked the generations one to another and enabled the next cohort of sages to renew the creative life of Torah, even after their teachers were no longer with them. So as I said, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava wasn't simply teaching Torah. What he was doing was mamish heroic. Now, there are various texts which deal with the death of the ten martyrs, and there is a text known as the Medrash Eile Ezkara. It's not a classical Medrash in the sense that it's not from the time of the Tanaim, but it's a very ancient Medrash that's quoted by a lot of the Achronim, maybe it's 7th, 8th century, something like that. And we're going to see that Medrash Eile Ezkara has a slightly different description of what happened to Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, different to what we saw in the Gemara, and different to what we see in our Piyutim. So I want us to look now at the Medrash Eile Ezkara. So, V'acharav hotziu Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, shelo tam shena ala kishena tzus, mechai shana ad peishanim. So what do we know about Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava? Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava never had a proper night's sleep from the time that he was 18 till the time that he was 80. Now, that's already interesting because that's in our Piyut of Arzei Alvanon that we quoted at the outset. We said he was killed when he was 70. So already we've got different traditions as to how old he was when he died. Did he die when he was 80 or when he was 70? Presumably the reason he never had a good night's sleep wasn't because he had an uncomfortable bed. And he's one of these people, when you ask him in the morning, how do you sleep? He goes, oh, terribly. Right? But he was busy the whole night, interrupting his sleep with learning Torah. When was it that he was taken out to be killed? He was taken out to be killed, or murdered, or executed, on a Friday. They took him out to be killed late in the afternoon. I assume that's significant. That's almost Plagah Mincha. That's when you're just getting ready for Shabbat. Not like it was Friday morning. It was Friday afternoon. The table's already laid. The floors are cleaned. The food, you can already smell it. It feels like it's Shabbat's almost with you. So he asked them, I don't suppose he asked them, he begged of them. Please, wait a little bit. Give me a chance. I want to have the opportunity to fulfill one last mitzvah. Amrulei, that's, they said to him, you still believe in a God? We've killed so many of your contemporaries, we're about to kill you. You still have anything to believe in? Amar lehu, he said to them, hey, yes, I do. Amrulei, they said to him, do you think this God has got any power, any strength? He can do anything? Amar lehu, he said to them, gadol adoni mehulam mo'od v'lidulato in cheker. My God is great, and you can't compare his greatness with anything else. You can't fathom it. I still have faith. Amrulei, they said to him, Im yeshbo koach lama lo hitzilot chavet chaverecha miyad malchut. So they said, well, if he can do things, why isn't he saving you? Amar lehu, he said to them, Anu chayavim mita lemelech gadol v'nora'a. We deserve death. Hum asar otanu biyad melech kedei litboet dameinu miyado. And you are just a puppet in the hands of our Kadosh Baruch Hu. Don't think that you're killing us because you hate us. You're killing us because that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because we deserve to be killed, and that's the role that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving you. It's similar to with Nebuchadnezzar HaRasha. It's made clear in the Navi that Nebuchadnezzar only was able to kill Am Yisrael because he was the archer, as it were, of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Same with Paro. Paro enslaved Am Yisrael on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this is Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava telling the Roman emperor, or whoever he's engaging with, that it's not you that's killing us, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bo v'agidu l'melech eretz dvarav. Shalach ha-melech ilav v'amarlo. So the emperor sent a message. Emet she'gidu l'imimcha olav. Is what they're saying in your name true? Amar lehu, he said to him, emetu, it's true. Amar le ha-kesar, that's the emperor said, Kama aze panim atem. You're so brazen-faced. Shal petach mita atem omdim. You're at the gateway to death. Vadayin azim atem. And you're still brazen-faced. You still think that you're better than we are. Amale Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda said to him, Oilach kesar. Woe to you. You are a rasha ben rasha. Now, he's got nothing to lose at this point, remember. They're going to kill him anyhow. They've taken him out to kill him. He's saying it as it is. Oilach kesa, rasha ben rasha. Halora achur ban beito, varigat chasidav tzadikav, lo asakina linake miyad. Do you think HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to see all this happening and he's not going to exact retribution? You've got trouble coming. Amru le Talmidav, so Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava's Talmidim said to him, Rabbeinu, Heilech halacha nifoto, that's, don't you think you should maybe sort of, stop insulting him? Amar lehem, v'chilo lamadetem shekol hamachanif l'rasha sofo nofel yado. You know, if I were to start being nice to him and start flattering him, so then, ultimately I'm going to become like him. Amar le, he said to him, Chayecha Kesa, Hamtein li ad shakayim mitzvah achat. I still want to have this chance to fulfill one mitzvah. V'shabbat Shema, it's called Shabbat for Olam Haba. And that is Olam Haba. Amar le, so the Caesar said, Nazeh shamati lasot sheilatcha. You know what? Fine. You can have your one last wish. Miad hitchil b'kiddush hayom. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava started making kiddush. I suppose, you know, Tesha Sha'ot. So it's now Plag HaMincha. He can make Kiddush. V'ayichul HaShamayim V'aretz. V'ayahomer bin Imut. And he said it with a beautiful tune. Uva Kol Ram. He didn't make Kiddush quietly. He made Kiddush loud. V'ayere v'ayvoke yom ha-shishay. V'ayutmehim al ha-omdim alav. Kol ha-omdim alav. How could everybody, how can he say Kiddush like this? With such simcha, with such an Imut, with such a loud voice. The Kevan Shegia ad Barai Lokim Lasot, and when he reached the words Asher Barai Lokim Lasot, Lohinichu Ligmor. They didn't allow him to finish, but Tiva Kesa Lahorgov Arguhu, the Roman emperor said, kill him, and they killed him, Yatzad Nishmato Beilokim, and he said the word Elokim, he died. Yatzda Bat Kol Va'amra, Bat Kol came and said, Ashrecha Rabbi Yehuda Shaita Domele Malach, happy are you, Rabbi Yehuda, that you're similar to an angel, v'yatzanishmatcha belokim, and your soul expires with the word Hashem, v'tivav chatchu evarim evarim, and then they commanded to chop him up, to dismember him, v'shlichu laklavim, and they cast him to the dogs, v'lo huspad, there was no hesped for him, v'lo hukbar, and he wasn't buried either. So we see, this is very different to the account in the Gemara. The account in the Gemara was that he was caught giving smicha to his five Talmidim, and they killed him by plunging spears into him. That's the account in the Gemara. The account in the Medrash Eila Ezkara is that nothing to do with him giving smicha. That he was taken out, he's caught maybe for teaching Torah, maybe for giving smicha, we don't know what for. It was Erev Shabbat, he tried to make Kiddush, they killed him while he was making Kiddush, and they chopped his body up. It's interesting, if we look in the Kina that we're about to read, Arzai al-Vanon, we see that was actually the fate of somebody else. Tzadik Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua Bachrona. So this is Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. Now Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, we saw previously, was one of the Talmidim that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava gave smicha to. Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua Bachrona, he was the last one to be killed. Ne'erag b'mad kira, he was killed by having a sword plunged into him. So that's, of course, what happened to Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava in the Gemara. Yom Erev Shabbat haya, it was Friday, which is what happened to Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava in the Medrash. Zman kiddush v'yikadesh v'yikra, time to make kiddush, and he made kiddush, and he called out. Cherev shalfu alav, they drew the sword. V'loi nichu b'chaim l'gamara. And they didn't allow him to finish it. Yatzta nishmato b'varai lokim. He expired when he said the words Hashem barai lokim yotzer v'tzatzura. So we see that there's obviously some confusion and different traditions about exactly who the Asara Harugei Malkut were, how they died, etc., etc. So we're going to now read Arzai Halavanon. It's on page 125 in the Rosenfeld, 248 in the Art Scroll. Every year it strikes me as just interesting that the Kina about the teaching of Torah is on page Resh Mem Chet, corresponding to the positive mitzvot in the Torah, in the Art Scroll, 415 in the Koren. Arzai halavanon adirai ha-Torah, balei treisin b'mishnah v'gmara, yiborei cholach amaleh ha-betara, damam nishpach v'nashetah gvura, hinam kedoshei harugei malchut ha-sara, balei le'anivochia v'ini. We're now going to move on to a kina which describes events that took place 1,000 years after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and that's the kinot which deal with the Crusades. We discussed them in some detail last year. Those were the tragedies that befell Kilot Ashkenaz, the communities in Germany, the Ashkenazi communities. Discussed at some length last year exactly what happened as far as that was concerned. Today I want to discuss something which, as I pointed out yesterday in Shul, doesn't appear in Arkinot, but a very famous episode. Geirush Sfarad, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in the year 1492, at the end of 100 years of Spanish persecution, and ahead of further persecution in that area of the world. And yet it doesn't find any reference whatsoever in Arkinot. And as I mentioned, even in the Spanish and Portuguese Kinot, they suffered, they were expelled, and there's still no mention of it on Tisha B'Av. So we'll bear that in mind as we consider that's what happened and why there's no real mention of it. And we'll try and get our heads around it. Let's just clarify, though, really what happened. We all know, yeah, in 1492, the Jews were kicked out of Spain, and they were kicked out of Spain on Tisha B'Av. We'll see exactly how that works out. That's, we know from the Jewish history that we're a bit familiar with, that Spain had the Golden Age of Spain. The Rambam lived and flourished in Spain. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, we're going to read his Kinot in due course. He lived and flourished in Spain. Spain was a Muslim country for several hundred years, and the Jews had a good experience there. They had religious freedom, they were able to be creative, religiously, philosophically, liturgically, etc., etc. It was very good for the Jews. It was an open society. In the 13th, 14th century, that Christendom gradually tried to overtake Spain, and it was successful in doing so. And this was a religious war. It was the Christians trying to reclaim Spain for the Christians from the Muslims, and they were essentially trying to drive the Muslims out of the country. There was a very large Jewish population, and the Jews became casualties alongside the Muslims. So it didn't start off as a particularly anti-Jewish campaign. It was an anti-infidel campaign, if you like, Jews and Muslims alike. Anybody who wasn't Christian that was under attack. 100 years before Geirush Sfarad, so in 1391, that was the first of the big pogroms. The word pogrom, of course, wasn't known by the Sfardim and probably hadn't been invented yet as a word, but the first of the attacks against the Jewish communities in Spain, that's the big attacks took place. If we look, I'm reading here on page 10 from Rabbi Abraham Levy and Lucien Gabay's book on the Sfardim. Tells us the Golden Age ended finally in 1391, when the pent-up jealousy of Christian mobs, whipped to fever pitch by determined priests, expressed itself in an outburst of public fury that, as a stroke, nullified the progress of centuries. But just to point out, of course, this, we could just transpose the words, and this would fit in perfectly with what we read last year about the Crusades. You know, exactly the same thing. Christian mobs, whipped up to fever pitch by Christian priests, that's attacking the Jews. That's, and point out, you know, we think about, you know, what is the worst of all the expulsions? We think about the worst of all the expulsions being Geirush Sfarad. In actual fact, Geirush Sfarad, it was terrible, and it was the worst in some regards. But in actual fact, everybody else in Europe had been doing this, you know, for hundreds of years already. You know, the Jews have been kicked out of England 100 years previously. The Jews have been kicked out of France. The Jews have been kicked out of other places. There have been the Crusades 200 or 300 years previously. So Spain was actually the last place to attack its Jews. First pogrom broke out in Seville, where, to quote a contemporary chronicler, on the 4th of June 1391, the Lord bent his bow like an enemy against the community of Seville. They set fire to the gates of the Jewish quarter and killed many of its people. And some of the women and children were sold as slaves. Some died to sanctify God's name, but many others violated the Holy Covenant and changed their religion to escape. So we see, and this is something which I don't think happened in England, don't think happened in France. That happened to some degree during the Crusades, but not extensively, the notion of conversion. That I think in England there were presumably, you know, individual Jews who tried to escape by converting, but I don't think there were mass conversions. And that's what we see happening during the Spanish Inquisition and Spanish expulsion, is that besides the expulsion of Jews and besides the murder of Jews, there was also the conversion of Jews. Jews were then massacred throughout Christian Spain, and one by one their centres of population were destroyed. Their persecutors offered the Jews the choice of baptism or death, and very large numbers chose to accept the cross in preference to dying as martyrs. A few willingly, some with reluctance, and most in sheer desperation. I think the numbers of conversions, there were those conversions we saw last year, you know, with the Crusades, but not to the extent that it's happened in Spain. One third of all Spanish Jews perished or fled overseas in the decades that followed the first pogrom of 1391. So already we think about the expulsion being in 1492. In 1391 already, a third of Spanish Jewry got up and left. A further third converted to Christianity, and only one third survived as openly professing Jews. So a third of Spanish Jewry to convert to Christianity, that is massive. The glory and pride of the community departed, never to return. But the remaining Jews of the Iberian Peninsula struggled on after the catastrophe, sustaining further losses through massacre and conversion, and also experiencing minor successes from time to time. Finally, all openly professing Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. At the end, many opted for the cross rather than leave their adopted homeland. So already, you've got a third that left and a third that converted. And then out of the last third, we're finding that still many of them converted. It is estimated that fewer than 200,000 Jews actually quit Spain in 1492. I don't know exactly what the term less than 200,000 Jews leaving means. 200,000 Jews is a lot. That means all of London Jewry and a chunk of provincial Jewry as well, and not much left after that. So 200,000 Jews is a lot of Jews. We'll see that there are other estimates who give it as much less than that. The remaining survivors of the once great community being lost to the sword or cross. Typical, perhaps, was the behaviour of the two most prominent leaders of the community, one secular and the other religious. So we have Don Abraham Senor, who's a name probably not familiar to most of us, Chief Justice of the Jews of Castile, was the courtier who'd helped arrange the marriage between Ferdinand and Isabella, which united Aragon and Castile and precipitated the decree of expulsion. Ferdinand and Isabella were the two monarchs who signed the decree of expulsion. The senor accepted baptism, and he was a rabbi, and he was a Jewish leader. And when it came to it, he accepted baptism, with the king and the queen and the cardinal of Spain standing as his godparents. Some sort of yichus, I guess. On the other hand, his deeply religious and learned colleague, who we have heard of in government, the great financier Don Isaac Abarbanel, had no hesitation in turning his back on Spain and going into exile. It would be hard to exaggerate the impact on the entire Jewish people of the expulsion from Spain. The sudden end of the greatest, the best established, and the most culturally assimilated Jewish community of Europe in the Middle Ages was a tragedy that seemed comparable only to the loss of their original homeland. In 1492, on the very anniversary of the loss of the destruction of the temple by the Romans, the shattered and bewildered Spanish Jews entered into a further and deeper exile. So the Bill of Expulsion was signed back in March, and it gave the last date that they all had to be out was a date in August, and I think that was extended by 10 days and brought them to Tisha B'Av. Most found refuge in Portugal, only to meet an even worse fate in that country 5 years later. Roughly the same time, Jews were expelled from Sicily, Sardinia and Provence. So that is roughly a potted history of what happened. And you can see that on page 12... that you can see sort of a map of the Jewish community spread out throughout Spain, And, you know, Spain was had Jewish communities all over, and where they were sent to. So it's interesting that we saw that Rabbi Levi and Lucien Gabay gave the number of those expelled as being around about 200,000. Martin Gilbert gives the number of expelled as being about 160,000. Cecil Roth says conservatively at over 150,000. Rabbi Beryl Wine says upwards of 200,000. So it seems like it was somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000. That's Rabbi Wine has a description of what happened as they left. Within the terms fixed by the edict of expulsion, the Jews sold and disposed of their property for a mere nothing. All right, so they had to get out, they could sell their property, but the market was flooded. They went about asking Christians to buy and found no buyers. Fine houses and estates were sold for trifles. A house was exchanged for a mule, and a vineyard given for a little linen or cloth. The rich Jews paid the expenses of the departure of the poor, practicing towards each other the greatest charity, so that except for a few of the very poorest, they would not become converts. In the first week of July, they took the hardship of the road upon themselves and left the land of their birth and children, children and adults, old people and youngsters on foot, and gentlemen mounted on donkeys and other animals and in carts. And they continued their journeys, each one to the ports to which they had to go. And they went along the roads and through the fields with great travail and misfortune, some falling, others rising, some dying, others being born, others falling ill. So that there was no Christian who did not feel sorry for them. So even their enemies felt had Rachmanus on them. Not enough Rachmanus to do anything, but Rachmanus. And always, through wherever they passed, real Rachmanus. The Jews were invited to be baptized. We can save you. And some, because of the hardship, converted and remained. But those were very few. So maybe very few on the way out, but previously, masses and masses. The rabbis strengthened their resolve and made the women and young people play on pipes and tambourines to cheer the people. So it's brought down in other sources that even though this was during the 3 weeks, they were allowed to play music during the 3 weeks because they needed to have their souls lifted. And thus they left Castile and arrived at the ports of the sea. Those who were to embark at the port of Cadiz, as soon as they glimpsed the sea, let out loud shouts, men and women, the old and children. In their prayers, they beseeched God for mercy and hoped to see some miracle of God that he might open a path for them in the sea. That's a contemporary description of what happened. Next page, page 13, you've got an image of what the edict of expulsion looked like. If you can read illegible Spanish, then you'll understand it. And turning the page, I've brought the whole text of the decree. We won't go through it, but the paragraphs 2 and 3 are of particular interest for people who want to read them, and they're saying it's explaining why the Jews were being expelled, because they're a bad influence on the Christian. You've got Jews who converted, but they're still crypto-Jews, that's Jews in hiding, and they're still practicing their Judaism, and they're being a bad influence on everybody else. So I said we don't have any kinot for the Geirush Sfarad. We don't, but kinot were written. I found in a sefer called Bina La'itim, and it also appears in various Sfardi Moroccan machzorim for Tisha B'Av, various kinot. I want to look at a kina. It's on the left-hand side there on page 17, Yom Mori. So firstly, the Sfardi kinot are very different to the Ashkenazi kinot. The Ashkenazi kinot, many of them are pretty impenetrable in terms of their Hebrew. That's the Sfardi kinot are much easier to understand, much easier Hebrew. And this one, I don't know who wrote it, Yom Mori, but it must have been somebody who was alive at the time, because when we see the descriptions, we'll understand that this could only be, you know, a witness to events. So Yom Mori Chashach, the day on which my light was extinguished, Begerush Castile, Oili Al-Shivri, with the exile of Jews from Castile, Oili Al-Shivri, woe for me, for the way that I've been broken. Now, the next line is, you know, really sums up how terrible it was. Sheve Yerushalayim al tizkeri od. Don't talk about the destruction of Yerushalayim any longer. That's, forget Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim's not relevant in the context of how we're suffering. It's all been superseded. That is very, very powerful. You know, Tisha B'Av, you know, we'll learn about the Shoah, you know, shortly. You know, we've encountered people whose parents were killed in Auschwitz. You know, that was terrible. But nobody says on Tisha B'Av, forget, you know, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Here, the Paitan is saying, forget the destruction of Yerushalayim. This is worse. Ahei alai vo'oyali. Moan for me and woe is to me. Ki l'sheve kastilia lo nimtza tzuri. Because I can't find any balm for the destruction of Castile. Mi Portugal nishma kol nehi b'mara. In Portugal they can hear the sound of my bitter cries. Ahei alai va'alalai. Wail for me and woe is me. Ki ein shever kishivri. There's no breakage like the way I've been broken. Umazor kamazori. And there's no illness like my illness. Az panim melech kashem nuval shemo. Brazen faced and despicable is his name was this king. Ehe alai. Sigh for me, v'oyali and woe to me. Ki shachach shem elohe yeshiva ori. He caused the name of my God of salvation and my light to be forgotten. Yiladim ha'omrim b'chol yom Shema Yisrael. Think about the children who every day say the words of Shema Yisrael. Ahei alai va'alalai. Wail for me, and woe is me. Omrim la'etz, they now say to wood, to the cross. Hakitza ula'even uri. Wake up, they say to the cross. And to the stone, they say, arouse yourself and save me. Talking about the conversion of those who were saying Shema Yisrael have now become Christians. Hama'echadim b'chol yom Adonai echad. Those who proclaim every day the unity of Hashem. Ahei alai v'oy ali. Wail for me and woe to me. Amru, they've said, Av ben v'ruach. That's a reference to the Trinity. The Father, the Son, and yeah. Ashehu yotri is my creator. Kimu v'kiblu avotam kocham. They said kimu v'kiblu. That's how the Jews accepted Hashem. That at the time of Mordechai and Esther, they said this, that they'll accept avotam kocham. Ahei alai v'alalai li. Amru shlosha eile. They said this trinity, hein kitri unaziri, have become my crown and my diadem. It's describing not just the exile from Spain, but it's describing the conversion of the Jews. Saftu v'nahu nihyeh. That's give hespedim and wail. Al beit hatifla. I'm not sure if this is al beit hatifla or beit hatfila. Beit hatfila is our destroyed synagogues. Beit hatifla is a reference to a church. That the Jews have gone into churches now. We should wail about that. Ahei alai v'oy ali. Eich sifrei kodesh nitmenu ba'afrai. How sifrei kodesh have been buried in earth. The chachamim, chasidim, v'anshei maaseh. The sages and the righteous, men of good deeds, have been killed. Ahei alai v'alalai. Amru, be'ishmet samti ani shivri. They said be'ishmet in a dead man. Again, a reference to Yoshki. That's, he's dead. He can't do anything. But they've put their faith in a dead person. Nahamnu hakel b'kiruv b'tshuah b'makom ehei arim b'tshuah before yagon v'eliha goali. So finishes, as all cannot do, with a prayer for the future. But we see this is a, this must have been a contemporary account or contemporary kina from an eyewitness of what happened. So my question, as far as this is concerned, is why is there no kina amongst the Ashkenazi tradition? So I don't have a conclusive answer. I don't even know if I've got a good answer, but I've got a few suggestions. One suggestion is that perhaps the nature of piyut just changed in terms of that Gerush Sfarad marks two events in Jewish history. One is something physical and one is something spiritual. What was physical? Physical was the Jews were kicked out of Spain. And this was the last of the big expulsions. what was spiritual about Geirut Sfarad marked the end of the period of the Rishonim. That's, we generally speak about the Rishonim to the end of the 15th century, and then it was the end of the Achronim. Rishonim are much more authoritative than Achronim. So in terms of creativity, religious authority and creativity, there was this shift with Geirut Sfarad, when, you know, so many Jews were forced out of one place to another, so many traditions, etc., were lost. And perhaps just the skill of writing piyut in the way that Ashkenaz knew it was lost. I mean, the Sfardim wrote piyutim afterwards, and we have the Kabbalists of Tzafat writing the Chadodin, Yidin Nefesh, and all the Anah B'chak, and all these sorts of things. But piyut, as we knew it, maybe came to an end. There were no further piyutim put into the tefillah, as far as I know, into the statutory tefillah, after that point in time. So maybe just it was the time when they weren't writing piyut any longer. That's one possibility. Another possibility, which is perhaps a bit more shocking, is perhaps maybe to Ashkenazi Jewry this was just a localized tragedy. You know, we look at it with 2020 hindsight vision. You know, we can see the global picture. You know, we count up the tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people over the course of history. And of course, the Spanish expulsion is one of those, you know, enormous things. But maybe to the Jews of Ashkenaz, who had their own kinot, their own communities and their own tragedies, you know, they'd had been expelled from England and from France, and they'd had the Crusades. That was a Sephardi Geschäft. In terms of it didn't touch them so much. They had refugees came to Ashkenaz and to Poland and to where they were, but maybe it just sort of, you know, tragedies have been fallen, Jews in Muslim countries all over the years. You know, the Sephardim didn't say kinot for the burning of the Talmud or for the Crusades. So maybe just communities were very, very insular. The biggest question, I suppose, is why did the S&P not have a kinah? You'd expect the Spanish and Portuguese to have a kinah for this. So I think that the answer is simply they are very conservative. In terms of where do they get their kinot from, they found an old machzor that's in the 1700s, they found a machzor somewhere dating back to the 1400s with the kinot for Tisha B'Av. That's the authentic Spanish minhag. And that's what they used, and they were all written pre-expulsion, so they didn't have any for the expulsion. That's why they didn't write any afterwards. It seems they just felt they were tied in to that tradition. So that's I say we don't have any kinot for the Spanish Inquisition, but I guess I just read one, and we'll continue now with the kinah for the. I was meant to give this later on, so we're going to read all together. I was going to read, have this as the introduction to Kinah number 9, but we'll turn to page 144 in the Rosenfeld, 304 in the Art Scroll, 515 in the Koren, that's, and sing Eshtukad Bekir B all together. That's, can somebody start us off?